Blog Talk Radio.
Plunged back through time, starting from 1924. Hello, everyone. This is You Found It, Masonic Companion, and I'm your host for the next little while, Dale Graham. It's a pleasure to have you here, as always. And I hope the program is educational, informative, or entertaining at the very least. If you have an opportunity to throw things at the screen and argue back even better. We have an interesting time today. This is the 18th of May, 2014, the 138th day of the year. Hard to believe that it's we're getting into summer so closely. It's not that long ago. You know, we're going to be that we were up to our waist in snow across this country, but we have brighter and better things to look forward to. We're celebrating Victoria Day here in Canada. This is an exceptional time. The Victoria Day. It happens on the 24th of May, as you know, because it's the Queen's birthday. We observe it either on the 24th or on the preceding Monday. Most of us, this means we can start planting, or we used to be able to think we could start planting our vegetables and flower gardens and put the winter behind us, but not so much. We know the seasons have gone a little bit sideways on the world. Our brethren in the Croatia and the Balkans are scrambling with flooding conditions, and our brethren in California with drought and fires. We have out of Wapiskat more flooding going on in First Nation communities, and we can be blessed in places like this. It's a little colder than usual. Right now I'm sitting here looking at 9 degrees outside, and still, we've got a lot of things to be grateful for in this country. Our day, Victoria Day, was named after Queen Victoria by royal assent. And she reigned over Britain. And it happens that the old girl was born on the 24th of May, 1819. And she enjoyed the longest reign in British history. So she went on the throne in 1837, and she ruled until her death in 1901. That was over 62 years. Our current queen, Elizabeth, has just passed her Diamond Jubilee, 60 years, which she celebrated last year. So longevity, old gene pools, we're not talking about the absurdity of the Habsburg shallow gene pool. This is a family that has at least the women, no question about it. The prince consort is well into his 90s and seems to be getting by. You may have joined a crowd of thousands over at Government House in Toronto to cheer for the Queen on this day. It's interesting if you're up around Ottawa just to see the celebration of our history. Whether we agree with it or not, of course, we're Canadians. We're going to be puckery little faced about it. We don't quite have that. We're still too new to celebrate and realize the strength of a common history. We haven't quite got there yet. To do that, we have to give up some things, and we're not quite ready. We're still a little young, and we're still a little bitter about some things. But the year of her birth, or the year of her death in 1901, the holiday became official. And since then, Victoria Day has commemorated two royal birthdays, the birth date of Queen Victoria and that of the current monarch, la-ti-da. It's a statutory holiday across Canada and across the territories in 7 out of the 10 provinces. In Quebec, French culture thrives and helps define this country. Fantastic. Fantastique. And it's celebrated as la Journée Nationale de Patrie, or National Patriots Day, in memory of the Anglophone and Francophone activists who fought for democratic government in 19th century Quebec. So, if you're enjoying a downtown stroll, you may see the Union Jack, you may hear the firing of 21-gun salute, or the Maple Leaf, you know, from sunrise to sunset in federal buildings. If you're in downtown Victoria, British Columbia, named after the Queen, there's usually hundreds of thousands, 120,000 watching marching bands and floats and clowns. Or you may just be one of the thousands of us, millions of us across the country, waiting for the darkness to look up at the fireworks. Ooh. So, you can suss this one out, Masonic geniuses. This holiday is also known as the May 2-4 weekend. Gee, I wonder what the origin of that could possibly be. Although with the temperature this cold, as all young stallions out there, former stallions, still stallions at heart will remember, putting your case of beer on the picnic table in the campground, it stays frosty cold in this kind of temperature. So that's the upside. That'll get you out to celebrate and keep us all focused. And I hope we have things Masonic to talk about. But I was feeling, you know, I wanted to just have that different sense of perspective this week that I wanted to bring to the show. No, there's the guesstimate here is that there's 5 million Freemasons worldwide. 5 million. Some speculators say 18 million, but I think probably 5 million is closer to the truth. The United States has a large portion of that. But in Canada, we have 180,000. Yeah. So I give you a little bit of trivia and context here. The number of Freemasons in the United States, about 3 million. Worldwide, the number of lodges, 33,700 lodges. 15,300 of those are in the States. 8,000 of them are in Canada, or in England. 1,600 in Canada. And in Australia, 580 lodges. And then Italy with 560 lodges. And of course, in Germany, 400 lodges. Cuba with 300 lodges. Let's put a little line under that. Cuba, 300 lodges. I'll bite my tongue about the politics that's weighted heavily on the shoulders of our brethren in Cuba. In the Philippines, 200 lodges. And we know the pride, the enthusiasm, the grasp of Freemasonry, of expatriate Filipinos to Canada, especially around some of the lodges in Toronto. Just remarkable. So get your pen out here. You don't have to. It's number of Masons in different lodges. And if you're the number of members belonging to a Freemason lodge in England, 600,000. And in Canada, 180,000. In Australia, 30,000 Masons. And Italy, some of these figures are kind of interesting. In Italy, 24,000. And in Germany, it's just narrowly behind, but 21,000. In Cuba, again, 20,000 Masons. Wow. It's like half the number here in Ontario, isn't it, across Cuba. In the Philippines, 15,000. Argentina, 2,500. Austria, 2,350. I'll go from the bottom of this list. It doesn't list every country in the world. France, 84,000. In Finland, 5,600. Chile, 14,000. Bulgaria, 200. And in Brazil, the second largest number here, probably the third largest number, I would say. Brazil has 198,900 Freemasons. Bring on the World Cup and let's see what you've got, Brazil. That's a lot. It's a lot of Masons in that area. What we're showing here is in California. I always thought that California had the most Masons in the United States, 188,000. But no. Ohio, of course, Ohio, 220,000 Masons. And over in Pennsylvania, right next door, 206,000. The same as South Carolina, 206,000. And then you go up and around the hip of Lake Erie into Michigan, 111,000 Masons. And then Tennessee. I think David Cameron may be the representative of the Tennessee, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe Kentucky, I'm sorry. Tennessee, 96,000 Masons. And in Florida, where a lot of the snowbirds light, 83,000. In Illinois, 88. Georgia, 90,000. So there, just to give a little bit of context for what's happening with Masonry around the world. It's coming up to the first, the longest day, but I want to give you a few things. We'll talk about that in just a minute, but I want to talk about some things that have happened in May. This is we're just past the date in May when the Lusitania sunk. This made me start to think about times past. The bitterness of war and it's not something that here in Canada we tend to think about day by day unless you're part of the trade and you're professional. The idea was that all of that sacrifice was done to be able to provide protection to a way of life, much the same as Grand Lodges provide the protection for the function and celebration and study of Masonic philosophies. It was on the 7th of May in 1915, the Lusitania was coming into Britain, and it was interesting. Interesting. It had a lot of passengers on board, but it was also transporting ammunition. There you have it. A German submarine sunk it with only one torpedo. Just about it was 12 miles off Ireland when it went down. 1,195 people died. 1,918 were on board that, and then that was a lot of them, 94 children. The bomb hit, but then it hit the magazine and boom, all was lost. And it was cold, the ocean there is cold. And it wasn't even escorted by a fishing boat. So there was no hope of rescue. President William Wilson had resisted European pressure to declare war right away. And the states were baited by American papers. You know, I know, throw your chest up and we're the noble protectors of the world. But you know, look at the history. It claimed that America would lose all Europe's respect if it didn't comply or didn't promptly declare war. Wilson did demand, and he did receive from Germany, a commitment to pay $2.5 million reparations, and in the future a commitment to give non-warships a warning before sinking them. And Germany thereafter generally complied with that for some time. Yeah. You know, like, get ready, we're going to sink you, but at least get to your lifeboats and your jackets. It seems that the reparations were made to harmed citizens of one nation by another. It's not usually determined by an amount of harm, but or the immorality, but the whims and prejudices and political regime. There you have a little bit. It was around this time, well, what are we looking at? Coming up the 23rd of May in 1915, Italy declared war on Austria-Hungary. Yeah, good. So, bit of something happening. If you and I were of that, had a strong back and stout frame, we might have heard the First World War. We might have heard this tune. This is called "The Last Long Mile." It's a World War I song. It's just a few minutes long, but from 1918. This is what our great-grandfathers would have been hearing.
Oh, they put me in the army and they handed me a pack. They took away my nightly clothes and dolled me up in pack. They marched me 20 miles a day to fit me for the war. I didn't mind the first 19. But the last one made me poor. Oh, it's not the pack that you carry on your back, nor the Springfield on your shoulder, nor the 5-inch truck of Clinton County door that makes you feel your limbs are growing older. And it's not the hike on the hard turnpike that wipes away your smile, nor the fuss of a sister that raised the blooming blister. It's the last long mile. Someday they'll send us over and they'll put us in a trench, taking hot shots at the Fritzes with the Tommies and the French. And someday we'll be marching through a town across the Rhine, and then you bet we'll all forget these mournful words of mine. Oh, it's not the fact that you carry on your back, nor the Springfield on your shoulder, nor the 5-inch truck of Clinton County door that makes you feel your limbs are growing older. And it's not the height on the hard turnpike that wipes away your smile, nor the soft of a sister that raise a blooming blister. It's the last on your back, nor the Springfield on your shoulder, It's a floating blister, it's a
I picture that coming at you with a poster of Lord Halifax, you know, the fellow with the commander's cap and braid with the large, large handlebar mustache. Your country needs you, pointing right at you. Desperate times. Huh? And there was no patterns for this kind of thing. No prototypes. They were inventing it as we went along. Lord Halifax, an interesting guy. He had four dogs. Shot, he called them. Shot. Mist. Dam. Let me think of the other one. Yeah, he had four dogs. Three dogs. Four, Shot, Mist, Dam. Interesting guy, you think about it. Name your four dogs. So if you can, here's the trivia for the day. If you can remember, you find the name of the last dog of the Lord Halifax and send it in to me. MasonicCompanion@gmail.com. That's a First World War inspiration. Innocent times, people weren't sure what they were going to get into, what they were getting into. There's still that notion of the noble warrior. We hear about that in Masonic circles. Some people, Masons on both sides, are laying down their weapons on a Christmas Eve in brotherhood. And we know that that happened at other times during the war when men on both sides were looking down the sights and didn't want to kill anymore. Don't think that it was just Freemasons that did that, but the stories about Freemasons doing it are compelling. Very compelling. I'm going to play a little bit of music by Vera Lynn in a minute, but we're coming up to get ready, all you worshippers of things nefarious and lunar. We're coming up to the summer solstice, June 21st, just after the World Cup opens in Brazil. That ought to be a party with those, 190,000 Masons running through the crowds. Remember, this is when the tilt of the sun, it goes up to the Tropic of Cancer. Then when it goes the other way, here we know this is summer up here in the Northern Hemisphere. When it goes the other way, tips into the Tropic of Capricorn. I had a blog for a while between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn. That's us. Yeah. This is where winter and summer solstices are exchanged so that the summer solstice is the day in which the sun is farthest south up here in the southern hemisphere. The common misconception is that the Earth is further from the sun in winter than in summer. Actually, the Earth is closest to the sun in December, which is winter in the northern hemisphere. Think about it. So as the Earth travels around the sun in its orbit, the north-south position of the sun changes over the course of the year because of the changing orientation of the Earth's tilted rotation axis. So the dates of maximum tilt of the Earth's equator corresponds to summer solstice and winter solstice. And the dates of the zero tilt, the vernal equinox and the autumnal equinox, right over the equator. Remember? Equinox, where you and I, for those brief moments, are truly in balance. And the reasons for these changes have to do with the Earth's yearly trip around the sun. For part of the year, the North Pole points away from the sun, and part of the time, toward it. And this is what causes our seasons. So when the North Pole points toward the sun, the sun's rays hit the northern half of the world much more directly. This means it's warmer and we have summer. So, all right, there you have it. So the actual closeness is not further away in winter, we're the closest. The days of the summer solstice is the longest of the year. and between sunset and sunrise, it's the maximum. So get ready to enjoy that. Our ancient brethren did and would have. But they were an alchemical bunch, weren't they? Truly and tremendously alchemical. Today is coming up to, my goodness, we're coming close to the birthday of a historically notable Freemason, an interesting polymath, I'll call him. But that just simply refers to somebody that is very well read in a number of areas. Elias Ashmole. You'll hear about the Ashmolean Library. I think that's in Cambridge, is it? Yeah. That's at Oxford. Yeah. Where it's his collection. So donated most of his collection, his antiquarian library and priceless manuscripts to the University of Oxford. Interesting man. He was born on the 23rd of May in 1617. And he was well known among certain circles as an antiquarian, studied the ancients, and a politician. And he was an officer of arms. And he was an astrologer. This is where things get a little more Masonically interesting at the time, I think, for the likes of me. And he was then a student of alchemy. Yeah. Alchemy is simply that. It's said to be an influential philosophical tradition whose practitioners have from antiquity claimed to be the precursor of profound powers. The defining objectives of alchemy are varied, but historically have typically included one or two: the creation of the fabled philosopher's stone and the ability to transfer base metals into the noble metals, gold or silver, and the development of an elixir of life, so that you could confer youth and longevity. We call that here beer. Alchemy, it does differ significantly from modern science because it includes a deeper philosophical sense than most of us would care to think about. It includes hermeticism, and that's just hermeticism is called hermetism, and it's a religious philosophical tradition based on writings attributed to Hermes Trismegistus, thrice great, that means. And these writings have influenced the Western esoteric tradition, believe it or not, and were considered to be of great importance during the Renaissance and the Reformation. So, and we've spoken about the Renaissance, the impact, and certainly there's not enough to be said about the impact of the Renaissance on us. But if we trace back, you see the thread going back from the importance placed on this. If for somebody like me that's, born to common stock, thinking if the great minds of the Renaissance and the Reformation thought enough of this material to study it and were influenced by it, then there's probably something worth looking at, something worth knowing inside of that. So that means I have to challenge my own narrow belief sets. I like being narrow. I like just having the world defined the way I want it to be defined, but too often I seem silly if I do that. There were a lot of people that studied this work. I'll give you just a little list of them. You want to see the kind of company. Christian writers, yes. Emerson, Lactantius, Thomas Aquinas, fairly influential, I would say, Augustine. Giordano Bruno, Marsilio Ficino Campanella, and Giovanni Pico della Mirandola. They all were considered Hermes Trismegistus to be a pagan prophet. Paganism was a term that was brought in by the Christians some time ago. I'm thinking 5th century. Correct me here. Just to delineate before us there was riffraff and now there's Christians. Basically, I'm expanding on that a little bit, stretching it, but on account of how Trismegistus received the name Thrice Great, you go and look at the Emerald Tablets, the tablet of Hermes Trismegistus. And there it's stated that he knew the three parts of the wisdom of the whole universe. And here they are. The three parts of the wisdom are alchemy, astrology, and something called thurgy. Thurgy, and that simply describes the practice of rituals, and sometimes seen as magical in nature and performed with the intention of invoking the action or evoking the presence of one or more gods, especially with the goal of uniting with the divine, achieving henosis, and perfecting oneself. I don't want to keep going on, but henosis is simply the mystical word for oneness, unity or union in classical Greek. Think about these definitions when you think about Freemasonry. That's all. Think about, and then bring yourself back to our contemporary setting. Are we practicing these things today? Well, no. Only in probably in some corners of our lodges do we hear these things kept alive. But the motivation for doing this is the curious mind. Only certain types of Masons, certain types of men, have the forbearance, I would say, to read back. And once you know about this history, it becomes kind of interesting. More than interesting, for some of us, it can become compelling. Isaac Newton, we'll throw out some well-known names. Not to say that the least known man in the lodge wasn't important, but Isaac Newton defines a period in our thinking. He placed great faith in the concept of an unadulterated, pure, ancient doctrine, which he studied vigorously to aid his understanding of the physical world. The same type of thing, I define that notion that we're supposed to be studying every single day to advance our Masonic knowledge. This is the way I translate that. This is what I think it means. Some of Newton's manuscripts, they're still not published, detail his study of the Corpus Hermeticum writing, said to have been transmitted from ancient times into the secrets and techniques of influencing stars and the forces of nature. We can look at them and mock them, but if you're curious to scratch the surface, you begin to have leanings towards something called Rosicrucianism. And I'll just leave you at that. I don't want to tip the apple cart, as they say. But when you're thinking about the futility of trying to turn base metals into silver or gold, you might want to look at that kind of a statement metaphorically. You might be closer to a truthful understanding of alchemy if you do that. So Elias Ashmole was one of them. Hmm? Yep. He was the celebrated for this, and he was an antiquary with a strong Baconian bent for the study of nature. That's getting back into a little chewier kind of work. We'll talk about Bacon at another time, I think. But there you have it, coming up to this time of year. 23rd of May was the birthday of a fellow that was said to be, the first known record of a man being initiated, was Elias Ashmole. He was an interesting guy. He was born poor. His family was aristocratic. They held themselves sort of you can be poor. Being poor is no excuse for being dirty or being illiterate. That was a movement the way of thinking that came out of this period. There was a nobility, he married real well. He married She married wealthy widows, and they needed companionship, and so did he. So an interesting man. When I finish a book I'm just reading called The Magus, which is all about Ashmole, I'll bring it on as a literature review on the show. We can't all have merry rich widows, I think. So think about alchemy. Is the world just a matter of the perception? Is that really what it is? William Blake said, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. But he also said, I love the workings of the mind of William Blake, the poet. He was an English painter and poet, and during his lifetime, generally ignored. So when we get around to the 28th of November, when he was born in 1757 in Soho, England, I'll mention him again. Maybe that's where I'll save the program, save up the topic to speak about him. But you start to get a sense of him. I'll just read you some, share some quotes. You'll get a sense of it. He who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. Great things are done when men and mountains meet. Think in the morning, act in the noon, eat in the evening, sleep in the night. He whose face gives no light shall never become a star. He who binds himself to joy does the winged life destroy. Without contraries is no progression. Attraction and repulsion, reason and energy, love and hate are necessary to human existence. No bird soars too high if he soars with his own wings. Join, connect. We have lessons, philosophical lessons, that are taught or achieved, or we bear witness to them in the context of other men. The tree which moves some to tears of joy is in the eyes of others only a green thing which stands in their way. Remember, not everybody sees the world the way you do and I do. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear as it is, infinite. I wonder what that means, the doors of perception were cleansed. Here he says the true method of knowledge is experiment. You want to learn something? You watch it, you study, you see what it can do and what it doesn't do. We'll come back. Good times. We're going to talk a bit today about, we have an interesting show. This one is called Measuring, Creating, Building, and Living. And so see what you think about this one. I know you're very patient with me. Thanks. So this is the theme for the program today. In the conventional sense, so say I, we should be much smarter, more sensitive, prescient, and aware. Has science not given 21st century man tools that were only decades ago the product of an active imagination? Communication is at our fingertips. Whole libraries can be carried in a pocket. A man with little in his pocket can have the education that once was the privilege of wealth and power. Poverty and slavery, disease and pestilence continue to haunt the tribes of mankind, crossing all boundaries. With the advantages of modernity, where is the balance? Where is the gain? The masses are entertained, mocking the suffering of unfortunate people. The pious have fallen. Leaders are so human and frail, we begin to wonder if standards of good behavior does matter at all. We are compelled to redefine a system that leaves the majority feeling the pain of hunger to support the wealth of a few. Is this greed? Is this advantage? Or is it insight? Humanism able to withstand the cynics? You know, the cynics will tell us nothing's going to change. Shut up. Be happy with what you have. If we had any other system, it's fraught with danger. The danger, you know, there's been different opportunities in all countries of having serious programs and talks about the systems of government and economics in other countries. Socialism, communism, capitalism being the three major. Yeah, we have oligarchs and theocracies going on, but those are small by comparison. The fear that these, it's really interesting. When I see a man that has confidence, he's not rattled because, you know, he's wearing a pink tie or he has to do something with his daughters that he thinks unmanly. I think a man of confidence is has his feet on the ground. He's more than a man that's becomes defensive and a bit absurd because of the way he's defined things manly. As Bob Dylan said, he doesn't smoke the same cigarettes as me. Remember that? Back in the 60s? So the cynics will make us afraid. The reason that we don't have serious conversation and study of these other systems of government is that there's a general fear between the countries and that if people learned about them, they would want to follow them. Now, this is curious that the thinking is in the Soviet or in China, if they were to learn about capitalism, everybody there would want it. But here's the interesting rub. If the people here that live in this so-called capitalist system, it's really, there's no open opportunities, no open access to markets. This is in the hands of privilege and wealth. It always has been. We're bright enough to study this now. But the thinking is if we learned about socialist systems and communist systems, that we would rush and embrace them. I'm talking to people that will have a sense that socialism is not communism. Very few, you know, the hysteria that we often hear, the hype, is that it's all the same, it's all the same. But here in Canada, we have a form of what socialism is that common good. And it's basic. It's putting aside the needs of one person or the ability of one person to become wealthy at the expense of thousands of other people. You put that aside and you balance it off. Yeah, we have to wait for access to health care. We wait and take our turn. We're Canadian. We don't have a problem with that. But if you want to be Americanized, you open your wallet and put yourself at the head of the line, because we all know that being able to do that means you live a better life and a healthier life and longer life, except it doesn't work that way. Yeah, utter and dire poverty shortens life. It's the ugliness of the world. So have we progressed? We are compelled to refine the system. How can we like a system when we know that, you know, that Occupy movement that was going on just a couple of years ago? Governments don't want us to think about that too often. Governments all over the world were confronted with people saying, hey, you know, when there's a problem with the investment, we pay, we suffer. And when there's a success from investment, you gain. We don't. People are beginning to, that's the emergence of republicanism, where people are saying, we, that's not fair. The system that we live in is based on that notion of fairness. And now we're saying handful of what, a couple of percent of people in the entire world own the majority of the wealth. It's not fair. So don't think that that this is just loose talk. The great minds have set themselves to unlock the secrets of redistribution of wealth. Yeah, it will happen. It's inevitable because this current system, as we know, is unbalanced. Behind the doors of our lodge halls, our apprentices expect to find answers to their questions. Too often he finds he is allocated to the chorus, where he is continuously solicited to volunteer and make a purchase, to give and give and give. Did we mean to replace the craftsman with a production line? Did we intentionally replace the meaning of a life worth living with nervous business models and money? How we define the Masonic experience is in our hands, as it always has been. If we bend history to serve an agenda, we fail the test of time. If we bend history to serve an agenda, we're manipulating history to serve an agenda. The revisionists, people that take a history and write out, change things to serve their purpose. That's what we call serving an agenda. Have we done that already in Freemasonry? One day we will understand the process that took us to this crossroads. Toleration of for poor quality work will ruin the reputation of any studio built around the talents of the master. Think about that. Think about the studio of Michelangelo, and what would happen if the supervisors of the works, remember, he wasn't alone, he had needed helpers. Remember, if they accepted poor quality work, what would happen to the reputation? We have only ourselves to answer that question, to answer these questions. But are we bending history? Understanding Masonic history is daunting. It's challenging because we create this this myth about the order. Well, we may have this idealized sense of the historic Freemasonry, but you and I don't live in an idealized environment. We are not idealized creatures. We are real. The world around us is real, and what it is, it's predictable, unpredictable. We do a lot of our thinking by habit. Oh, we do have our own conceits, notions that we're on top of things, and my goodness, we're brighter than the rest. That whatever we think is accurate and truthful, well, it is what it is. It's perception. Perception is reality, after all, isn't it? So, it's an unfair thing to do to say, to mention the toleration of poor quality work, but we do. It's not to say we have to lop off heads. This isn't a Lewis Carroll novel. No. It's what we do. We start with we are average, not we are privileged, we are cut above. Then we have to immediately begin to redefine us. Well, we don't become different if all we're doing is, you know, adhering to the emperor's new clothes. Remember the story of the emperor's new clothes. The crafty tailor convinced the emperor that his cloth was lighter and translucent and more form-fitting and more complementary to the figure of the emperor. And when The emperor walked out into public. People mocked and laughed at him because he was naked. But he loved it. He was the man in power. Is that what we've become? Dressing up becomes more important than why we're there or what we're going to talk about. I think Freemasonry then becomes a common purpose education. Man, is it, do we collectively seem to have difficulty with people who dig their heels in? They bring in something from the public that is hard to scrape off the walls of the lodge. You can't make me. We never did this before. Generations upon generations of Freemasons. Yeah. Good time, Charlie's. We've heard about that from the Sankey lecture this year. Well, you can have a better time at a Boston Pizza, drinking beer and watching sports with your friends. There's lots of different organizations that are better at having a good time. Oh, you can wear suits, yeah, and make it special and exclusive, yeah. Golf and country clubs do that all the time. So there's nothing different or exclusive about Freemasonry in that frame of reference. The only time when Freemasonry, you're beginning to connect with Freemasonry, is when you begin to think about the craft exceptional. What is different and exceptional about that happens inside the order that doesn't happen anywhere else? Somebody full of themselves, well, that happens quite often. Somebody that's aggressive, well, that happens. It's tedious. The Freemasonry is so odd, so difficult, the challenge, because it expects us to probe, to open our minds. And I think it's hard because we do this without a lot of hands-on guidance. You go into this craft and you begin to realize there are hundreds of thousands of opinion papers out there. And you can put them into general streams after a while. Square and compasses has been done ad nausea. Each time by somebody who's discovering it for the first time. But as a body of work, stories about the bits and pieces, the history of the provenance, they've been done a lot. Is that what we're about? The history of a gavel or when a lodge room opened? Really? Yeah, it's curious. We like to put, but we can do that with a little plaque. This lodge room opened in 1857. There you go. And its number is whatever it is. 90. There you go. Is that what Freemasonry is? Hardly. Hardly. That's us studying ourselves. Studying. But if we haven't done anything else, my goodness, what else do we have to study? We don't have philosophical writings from the 19th century and 20th century to fall back on? Do we see the intellectual struggle? Did the humanist philosophy begin to change the way that Freemasonry functioned? Well, the only way we're going to know that is by studying it. Studying it, yeah. And we have plenty of opportunity to do that. But we're done with some things. We've moved ahead as we always do. Always. I want to talk a little bit though about the history of the world. Give you a little history lesson, but this is about beverages. Mm-hmm. You know, we're coming up. Just a little aside. You've heard about the Conference of Grand Masters. Most of you have heard about that. I'm going to tell you what that is, just so you know what's going on. It's no mystery. This is an annual meeting of Grand Masters in North America. Grand Masters of Masons. And currently the membership of the Grand Lodge is the Grand Lodges of the provinces of Canada, the states of the United States of America, including the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, the states of Mexico, the American-Canadian Grand Lodge of Germany. And these Grand Masters represent some 2 million Freemasons in North America. Grand Masters from countries all around the world tend to join in. But it's, quote, considering the checkered history of Masonic congresses and conventions from 1780 to World War I, no achievement of the Conference of Grand Masters of North America is more outstanding than its survival as a voluntary annual meeting of the leaders of the craft. It answers a need of Grand Masters to know each other and to learn how others are meeting and handling the problems of the fraternity in their jurisdictions. And that's from a book by Most Worshipful Brother Conrad Hahn, H-A-H-N. He's a past Grand Master of Connecticut, called the A Short History of the Conference of Grand Masters of Masons in North America. It's published in 1963. The one coming up, if you're around in Vancouver, I don't think we're allowed into this unless you're a Grand Master. It's coming up in February, between the 14th, Valentine's Day, and 17th, 2015, the Hyatt Regency in Vancouver, British Columbia. So that's the Conference of Grand Masters, and that's what they do. You know, you want to find out, you know, learn from the tradesmen that are doing the work that you do. We've always learned that way. It's brilliant. Brilliant. So it's nice to see that our Grand Masters, you know, where do you go to sit down with a bunch and just have a drink and put your feet up and say, hey, what's going on with your jurisdiction? You know, it's not an elitism. That's just basic, you know, craftsmen do that. Wise people do that. We're, before I get on to, I'm going to talk a little bit about, finish up about wine. Imperial Vine, Rome versus Greece. We want to bring you a little bit further with a bit of music from the Second World War. Those of you who were around were inspired by this. And remember, the men of the First World War were read material. Their most popular books would be considered today a bit of a romantic, emotional story. But they were trying to escape what they were living through. And I won't fault them, nor will I laugh at them, nor will I ever laugh at that kind of, and to be dismissive of that kind of literature ever again. They read, I'll talk to you about that later. This is a song called We'll Meet Again. You think about it, it's in 1939, and the British singer Vera Lynn did this. The music is written by, and lyrics, Ross Parker and Huey Charles. It's one of the most famous songs of the Second World War. What do you do when you're marching off and there's you know damn well that a lot of you are going to die? Well, you want to be brave. You want to be brave for the people back home, for your parents, so they're not too afraid, for your brother and sister, for your girl.
We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when. I won't be long. They'll be happy to know. again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Always remembered, that we can't expect kids to pick up on all of that unless they lived in the battlegrounds. It's really hard. This is like something happening that's unreal. It's happening in another place that doesn't exist around us. People dying for us that we don't even know. For reasons that we haven't thought about or haven't been taught. Vera Lynn, I can't... first time I heard that, and then where it struck home was when I was in my 30s. And I realized what she was doing was she's, through that song and her smile, she was simply sending a message of hope. If Freemasons have failed to do that today, shame on us. You are that man, that quiet man, who lives within the sphere of his own life. You want to be him? You already are him. When you hear about him and it affects you, now the question is, want to know Masonic secret? Here it comes. Ask yourself how that man would act. And do that. Would he never swear? Get over yourself. Would he never be put on the spot? Get over yourself. Of course he would. Would he always act like a pompous ass? Only if he was a pompous ass. Get over yourself. He'd be reasonable. When he made a mistake, he would apologize. He would do things to save face. William Blake says it's easier to forgive an enemy than it is a friend. Pythagoras says it's easier to... One of the most difficult lessons for us is to control our emotion and to be quiet. How to be that man? Well, those are lessons that we need to grasp. That means that we walk off with a sulk... upset and angry, and then we realize that we're expected to handle it, to find balance and reason, to forgive, or to act as if the insult never happened, or to shrink it as quickly as possible, to hide the wound, keep it within yourself. Those are the lessons that, are they bigger than life, or are they real? Well, even if we can approximate 99% of it, we're pretty darn good. Yeah, coming up, we're going to wrap up the show in a little bit. Baths, wine, and sex ruin our bodies. But what makes life worth living except baths, wine, and sex? Ha-ha! This came from Corpus Inscriptionis, the number 6. Yep, they'll ruin our bodies, but don't they make life worth living? You got to decide. And if you're out there and you're on the wagon, I respect that. When I say that I don't trust people that don't drink, I respect it. If you've got health problems because you've imbibed too much, I've got it. Doesn't mean you're not a drinker. It means that it's harmful to you. Don't do that. Everything in moderation, boys. Everything in moderation. But when I've ever met somebody that's pious and walking around and you know, they just bring it out when you're trying to relax and pour a drink for everybody. Oh, I don't drink. Well, their only reason they're doing that is just to piss me off. So they no longer piss me off. It's like, what? Why would you do that? I can't trust you. If that's what you're doing, you call yourself a friend and you're sitting down and you're pulling that kind of crap, man, I don't want to know you. Just people do that, and it's not like they're making themselves better or more improved. It's like just doing it to be an annoying little shit. We're going to talk about in the middle of the second century. Are you okay to plunge back? So close your eyes, stand up nice and straight, cross your hands across your breast, and fall back into time. Just let yourself go. Boom. Fall back we're falling for a few thousand years before we have a soft landing in the second century. Come on, you can do it. Let go. Don't let go of the steering wheel if you're listening to this in the car. And which I suspect some of you are, but come back in time. The second century, the Romans, and they were around central Italy, had kicked the Greeks out as the dominant power in the Mediterranean basin. Well, that was inevitable, wasn't it? And they borrowed, but of course, the Greeks were a good time. So the Romans borrowed their Greek gods and the myths, like the myths are even today. And here's a little takeaway, right? Write this one down. Echo and Narcissus. Echo and Narcissus, an interesting relationship between those two gods. Nymphs, really, they were. So go and check that out. Echo has really been, that's sort of a mantra of mine for the last couple of weeks since I read a little more about Echo, the wood nymph that always had to have the last word, chatterbox. The Roman constitution was modeled on Greek lines, and educated Romans studied Greek literature and could speak the language. Well, of course, this is like the most profound and pronounced and influential culture that had been. And some of us could easily say, and has ever been, all of this led some Romans to argue that Rome's supposed victory over Greece was in reality a defeat. As fine Greek statues were triumphantly brought into Rome after the sack of the Greek colony at Syracuse in 212, Cato the Elder, curmudgeonly Roman, who regarded the Greeks as a bad influence, remarked that the vanquished have conquered us, not we them. He had a point. Cato and other skeptics contrasted what they regarded as the weak, unreliable, and self-indulgent nature of the Greeks with the Romans' practical, no-nonsense manner. Greeks. Maybe Athens he's talking about, but not Sparta. Spartans were, they weren't the people, they weren't the laid-back party people. They were more... you would think of them as more of a militant culture. Yeah, the kids, the boys were taken away at 10 and were brought into these groups of other boys where they learned to exist in tribally and toughen up. Yeah. The paradoxical results, you see, you know, what did you win? Well, we broke that. It's like burning the Sophia Hagia. You know, you burn the library. There you've got a victory, you geniuses. You burned all of the wisdom of the past centuries, you geniuses. The paradoxical result was that while many Romans were wary of becoming too much like the Greeks carried the intellectual and artistic legacy of the Greeks even further than before. as her sphere of influence expanded around the Mediterranean and beyond. After successful campaigns, Roman soldiers were often rewarded with tracts of farmland. Cool. The most prestigious crop to grow was the vine. By doing so, Roman gentlemen farmers could convince themselves that they were remaining true to their roots, even as they also enjoyed lavish feasts and drinking parties in Greek-style villas. Well, why not? We learned about that. The symposia and the kratos. You all have your big bowl where you pour in the strong wine, and we have our aides just watering it down enough. And we should remember the toast, the five toasts. You all have that. The first is to health, right? The second to wisdom. But I like the fifth, to mayhem and violence. So you drink too much? Silly. At the beginning of the second century, Greek wine still dominated the Mediterranean. It was popular and was good. And it was the only product being exported to different quantities, lots to the Italian peninsula. But the Romans were catching up. Greek colonies in the south, they were all under Roman rule by that time. And the Italian peninsula became the world's foremost wine-producing region around 146. And just as they assimilated and then distributed so many other aspects of Greek culture, the Romans embraced Greece's finest wines and winemaking techniques. By 70 AD, the Roman writer Pliny the Elder estimated there were 80 wines of note in the Roman world, two-thirds of which were grown in Italy. Wine was shipped from one part of the Mediterranean to another in freighters, typically carrying 2,000 to 3,000 clay amphora, along with secondary cargoes of slaves and nuts, glassware, and perfumes. And some winemakers shipped their own wine, and wrecks have been found in the name of the winemaker on the amphora matches the name cast into the anchor. So most of the best wine ended up in Rome itself and arriving at the port of Ostia, a few miles to the southwest, a wine ship could be unloaded by a swarm of stevedores. And then it was put in dim cellars in wholesale warehouses and transferred into vast jars sunk into the ground to keep them cool. For here, it was sold to retailers and transported in smaller bottles through the city's narrow alleyways and with handcarts. And here's an impression of the bustle on the street. We are blocked in our hurry by a surging mass before us, while the great crowd crushes our backs from behind us. An elbow or a stick hits you. A bean or a wine jar smacks you on the head. My leg is caked in splashed mud from every side. I'm trampled by shoes and a soldier's spears, my foot with his spiked shoes. Having made its way through the chaotic streets, wine was sold by the jug from neighborhood shops, and Rome households sent their slaves down with empty jugs to buy the wine and bring it back. Wine from the far provinces of the Roman world then reached the tables of average Roman citizens. It was not often that choosing one wine over another is a matter of life and death, but that is what determined the fate of Marcus Antonius, a Roman politician and renowned orator. In 97 BC, he found himself on the wrong side of one of Rome's many power struggles. Gaius Marius, an older general, had seized power and he was hunting down supporters of his rival, Sulla. Marcus Antonius sought refuge in the house of an associate of far lower social class, hoping that nobody would think of looking for him in a house owned by a poor guy. His host, however, unwittingly gave him away by sending his servant out to buy wine worthy of such a distinguished guest. The servant went to the neighborhood wine shop and, after tasting what was on offer, asked for a far better and more expensive wine than usual. When the vintner asked why, the servant revealed the identity of the master's guest. The vintner went straight to Marius, who dispatched a handful of soldiers to kill Marcus Antonius. Thus, having burst into his room, the soldiers could not bring themselves to kill him. Such was the power of his oratory. Eventually, their commanding officer, who was waiting outside, went in to see what was happening. Denouncing his men as cowards, he drew his sword and beheaded Marcus Antonius himself. Like the Greeks before him, the Romans regarded wine as a universal staple. It was drunk by both Caesar and slave alike, but the Romans took Greek connoisseurship to new heights. Marcus Antonius' host would not have dreamed of serving him the lesser wine he drank himself. Wine became a symbol of social differentiation and an important form of conspicuous consumption. It showed that you were rich enough to afford the finest wines. And we still have a kick out of that, don't we, gentlemen? We watch somebody drinking a mouthful of plonk, but it has just the most gorgeous label on it. There you have it. Mm-mm. Aren't I smart? Well, I'm going to finish up today with a little bit of the history. I'm going to find out if anybody in the Goon Show was a Mason. That was a program that started in Britain from 1951, just after the Second World War. Served a purpose. There's always a purpose. But I need to know a little bit more about that show, and I'll bring that up in the upcoming. But I want to share with you, we'll get into a little bit of music by Masons, one written by composer Joseph Haydn, a brother Joseph Haydn, played by a brother Wynton Marsalis. He's of the Prince Hall inclination. But before I do that, I'm going to share a song with you. This is the first song my little girl sang, and I was giving her a bath, and she must have been maybe 3 years old. And her mother has always been a fan of show tunes, Broadway show tunes, and it was one of the things that fascinated me about her when we were dating, that she knew show tunes and would, just a huge fan. Well, apparently she taught this song to her daughter, or she sang this song to her daughter, and lo and behold, her daughter picked up on it. And this is the truth, gentlemen. It just staggered me when I heard her. She was just playing with her little ducks floating around in the tub, and she broke into a chorus of this. Sing along if you can.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York. These vagabond shoes are longing to stray.
Brethren, it's been great. I'll look forward to seeing you again sometime soon. May the great architect watch over you. Commit your random acts of kindness. See ya. Hearing that from a three-year-old. Here, this is Haydn's trumpet concerto, Brother Haydn, Wynton Marsalis. Bye.
Make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on. Always look on the right side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you.
And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. Pressing death is seen, you know. nothing will come from nothing. You know what I say? Cheer up, you bugger. Come on, give us a grin. There you are. See? In the film. Incidentally, this record's available in the foyer. How much I live as well, you know? What do you think pays for?